And in that case, there has been some question.
House Committee on Labor, February 6, 1989, hearing room.
1870.
Call the House Labor Committee to order. This morning, we have three work sessions. We're going to start with House Bill. We're going to go out of order a little bit here and start with House Bill 2304. This is the bill that would conform the state to the federal, for lack of a better term, plant closure bill. And you have some amendments, I hope, the dash one amendments. We asked the Department of Economic Development to, if you'll remember, at the public hearing to come back with, to fill in the blanks in the bill, as well as check with certain conformity issues with the federal government. These amendments accomplish that. So if you want to take a minute to look at those.
Where are the amendments at?
2304-1.
Yeah, I handed them out. All the amendments to all these bills are up in your office.
Not mine.
Do we have any copies of those amendments, Matt?
Oh, I thought mine maybe.
I took them up Friday.
I think
she put her ears in.
Yours, mine are in here. I know because I already looked at one.
I got the other amendment, the one that you sent me on.
To Laverne, I said.
2348.
On having the next.
Full set, yes.
Anyway, there's 2348.
23.
You bring them all up together? They're all put together.
Aha!
Good morning, I'll be sure.
I see what it is.
You got it now?
I got her now. All right.
Make any comments on this, Matt?
Essentially, the bill, the amendments are to put everything into conformity and to also attempt not to duplicate federal law. They also, instead of where it says business resources, instead of the economic development part, they wanted to identify exactly who it was that's going to do it. So it's going to be the Job Training Partnership Act section in the Business Resources Division of the Economic Development Department, so that it would be the same one that the governor has already appointed. Everything else is insertion of the correct bill, the Public Law 100-379, and there are a couple of deletions, and those deletions are to keep from duplicating the federal law.
Okay.
Other than that, there's no, as far as I can tell, there are no substantive changes.
All right. Any questions on the amendments? St. Johnson.
We discussed this on Friday, as I recall, but the agency is totally happy with this now.
That's my understanding. Mr. Brawley is.
Mr. Brawley.
Brawley is here. Mr. Brawley, you want to come up? Yeah. And others. Good morning.
Good morning.
Bill, could you just very briefly just give this your stamp for whatever you want to say?
Mr. Chairman, we basically here have simply tried to simplify this. This will meet our needs without creating any undue difficulty for the department or causing any confusion in the community, which is basically what we're attempting to
avoid. We appreciate that. For the record, Bill, could you state your name and agency?
My name is Bill Brawley. I am Assistant Manager of the Job Training Partnership Act Administration of the Economic Development Department.
Okay. Max, you had a question?
Yeah, the last amendment, piece of the amendment, it says on page 2, line 8, delete economic. Mr. Brawley, I think there was some question about that particular area of the reporting to be done from the committee. Do you want to address why we took that out?
Essentially, our rationale there was if an employer is gone, it's going to be difficult to do an economic workup on them. Our anticipation is that with each closure, we will do a full final report, which will describe the reasons for closure, the situation at the time we got there, and everything that we have done up into and including getting as many of the individuals retrained and back to work as possible. So our anticipation is that we will roll these reports up into the annual report. There will be certainly some economic information in there. Basically, we were after just a status report, which would give us the flexibility to, if we had the information, to put it in. If we didn't, not have a requirement to do something that wasn't out there.
Okay, that's all.
Thank you, Bill. Okay. Representative Johnson moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2304. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dominey.
I move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
This, goes right to the floor.
Yes.
Okay, you're correct. Representative Dominey moves House Bill 2304 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that? Hearing none. Laverne, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Mannix.
Aye.
Representative Walden.
Aye.
Representative Witte.
Aye.
Representative Durfler.
Aye.
Representative Dominey.
Aye.
And Chairman Shipwreck.
Aye. House Bill 2304, as amended, is sent to the floor with a due pass, and I think Representative Dominey would be appropriate to carry this bill, being a member of the woodworkers. Okay. Let's go on to work session on 2348, the designated adjuster bill. I spoke with Mr. Young of the Workers' Compensation Division, and the amendments, let's check, make sure you've got those amendments.
That's actually an gross bill.
Yeah. Okay. Here I'm speaking and I don't have them.
It happens to us all the time.
Or bigger rule. Does everybody have a copy of the hand and gross amendments to that? Max is going to explain. They are hand and gross, but have been approved by, as I understand, Legislative Council. Legislative Council is really busy right now. And Chuck has signed off on these. Apparently. Go ahead, Max.
When I took the amendments down to Legislative Council, they had a huge amount of bills working on and amendments to get out last Friday, and they were real understaffed because of the weather. And I, on both 2348 and 2320, I went over these amendments, and essentially, Legislative Council is okay with the language and shouldn't have a problem with them. Okay. And on this bill, on 2348, there's two sections that have been amended. Down on line 23, there are two additions. The first addition, I'll take the second addition first. It says, notwithstanding subsection 3 of this section, an insurer may not. B says, have more than 8 locations at any one time where claims are processed or records are maintained. As you recall, this bill is allowing insurance companies to have more than one place to have their claims processed or records maintained. The department, workers' comp division, had a concern about a proliferation and a progression of this, and a number was arrived at that they could deal with. A, on the other hand, is language that says An insurer may not enter into a service agreement contract with one of their insureds. Now that would, that's pretty simple. An insurer can't say to a big corporation, we'll insure you and you can handle your own claims processing. It does two or three things, and we can get into that. The second part of that said, unless the insured has service contracts with other insurers, what we want to be able to allow is for somebody who is doing servicing of contracts for various people to have their insurance from one of the people that they insure, as long as their business is service contracting. And the other one is on the second page. It does the same thing for self-insureds. It increases theirs to three locations where claims are processed or records are maintained at any one time. I'll answer questions if you have them.
I'm going to ask Mr. Young to come up just to, for the record, discuss these changes. And yeah. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Larry Young, manager of the compliance section of the Workers' Compensation Division.
Do you want to make any comments, Larry, as to the amendments here?
Mr. Chairman,
just for the record, so
at the last hearing, we really didn't have any responses to alternatives, and so after the last hearing, we went back and looked at the situation. And the concern is the competitiveness. This allows them to have eight different service companies at any given time, or one service company with eight locations at any given time, or any combination thereof. And that gives us a cap that we can work with as far as to maintain our cost or know what our costs are going to be. And with that, it's very acceptable to us.
One of the things that we talked about, Larry, and I guess it's already in the current law, we were concerned about a service company outside the boundaries of the state, but apparently it's current law and we're not changing the fact that these would have to be within the state of Oregon.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Wanted to make that clear, too.
Does any
of this, Representative Johnson?
Does any of this affect the self-insured groups? I'm thinking of 4A.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the testimony by the Self-Insured Association was that they would like the opportunity to try out another service company for competitive purposes also. And so this gives them their own location and three locations, or three service companies, however they want to do it. And it would, we don't differentiate between the self-insured and groups in that regard.
I guess what I was getting to is that if a carrier couldn't, and a carrier couldn't write the umbrella policy and have the self-insured do their own work, which is what they do, that's what I want to be sure that isn't what's happening.
The other part of the language, which was of that, I don't know what subsection it is, Max, but takes care of that concern you have, yes,
okay.
And was one of our concerns.
Representative Domini, then Representative Mannix.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I think we discussed it the last time we had our hearings, but is there going to be a physical impact on the department? And if there is, do you have any idea what that is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Domini, there will, if we maintain the current status the way everything was, there would be an impact in this, depending on how many locations there actually end up being. There's no way of knowing at this point in time if there will even be any service companies moving to state or locations. But if they are, then, and we are required to audit them for the verify reserves, and we will be eventually, then the additional travel required and just plain staff time to carry out those audits will be there. How much that is at this point in time, I do not know. I believe there's probably been an impact statement done. We're speculating, I think, in one field auditor is what we talked about. But I don't, until we know how many actually come in state and locations they set up and use, we won't have any idea what that cost will be. But there will be a cap on it. That's what this amendments do.
Representative Mannix.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that, I understand or assume that if there was an increase in expenses, that the way that's taken care of is there'd have to be a change in the assessment against premiums.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, not necessarily. There could be, if it was that much, there could be also be just a change in emphasis and direction of the audits themselves.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
So the fiscal impact we're talking about is relatively minor, and it's within that ballpark figure that you have to deal with all the time in dealing with your role as a regulator?
As far as the premium assessment is concerned, that's correct, yes.
One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Mannix.
In regard to this language in subsection, or section 4, I guess it is, beginning at line 24, I wasn't quite sure of the impact of subsection A, and I was wondering if you could give me a quick idea of the dynamics of the relationship that we're talking about. Entering into a service agreement contract with one of their insureds, referring to an insurer, unless the insured has service contracts with other insurers. Is that basically saying that insurance company X has an insured in the state of Oregon? I'm just trying to play this out. That insured would have to have service contracts with other insurance companies in the area of workers' compensation in order for this kind of agreement to be effective for the insurance company and the insured.
Mr. Chairman, basically, yes.
Because it doesn't say limited to workers' compensation, but I guess that's the assumption since it's all...
It is because it
relates to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's go up to lines 8 and 9 under subsection 1.
Okay, chapter 656. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Good point.
Representative Johnson.
I did have one last question. Do you have the ability to mandate that there be some single location where there would be a record of where claims were or not? Getting to this point of the 8 locations, can you by rule establish that there must be one location where there's at least a record of where all the claims are, files are? My point being, if you have 8 locations, you could spend all day chasing down a file if there wasn't some way to deal with it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we probably could do it if it became a problem. I wouldn't do it with this particular language until it became a problem, then I'd probably come back and talk to you about it before I just do it by rule in that regard. The insurer is ultimately responsible. If we can't find something, if something doesn't come in time, we'll just hit them with a penalty.
Okay. It's that simple,
and
if you got Joe Worker who has a problem, something else, and if it takes a longer time to find a file, I would think you would want to have a record.
Normally, if we find a trend like that at all, if we get 4 or 5 or 6 complaints coming in, we call up whoever's managing that particular outfit and tell them they have a problem. And if they don't get it fixed real soon, it's going to be a serious problem. And normally, we stay on top of it that way.
Would you prefer to have us insert some language in here that says that one single location will be maintained to keep a record of where all files are at?
Not until it becomes a problem, Representative Johnson, unless
okay.
It just makes more work for everybody.
We're currently allowed 6 now.
Yeah.
Any further questions of Mr. Young? Thank you, Larry. Okay. Representative Johnson moves the amendments, the hand engrossed amendments to House Bill 2348. Let the record show that these have been approved by Legislative Council.
We will take them back and have them fixed before we go to the floor.
Is there any objection to the amendments? Hearing none, so. Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2348 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? I'd only make one point on the audit procedure. Because of the presence of this bill, as you will remember, there was some discussion about the extensive auditing processes that the department is engaged in. Mr. Young has agreed to meet with the very insurers, both private and self-insured, to see if there are ways to make some efficiencies in that system. And I'll be waiting to hear from Mr. Young if those people show up at the meeting this time. Okay. Sometimes we hear a lot of complaints and nothing gets done. Let's call the roll, Laverne.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Mannix.
Yes.
Representative Walden.
Aye.
Representative Witte.
Aye.
Representative Durfler.
Aye.
Representative Domini.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2348, as amended, is sent to the floor with a due pass. I'll carry the bill. Okay, last but not least, House Bill 2320, work session. We had a informal meeting on House Bill 2320. Some amendments have came out of that meeting. I'd like to say that for the most part, there was great deal of agreement on the bill. Some people on the committee and others have testified in front of the committee that the trucking industry is somewhat unique. It was the consensus of the people at the meeting that we had that the trucking industry seek another vehicle to accomplish what they hope to accomplish. There simply is no room in, under this bill for their specific industry problems, and that's the extent of that. The amendments, does everybody have those amendments?
Dash two amended.
Dash two as amended. Max, you want to go through and explain for the public the amendments that we've got in front of us here?
Well, the amendments, 2320-2, and then there's a little thing that says amended, do a couple things. The first thing they do is it turns around Section 1 of the bill and makes the mandatory parts of the bill first. Representative Mannix did some rewrites on this earlier, and it does read, I think, sufficiently well, or at least better than the previous. If you'll notice, 1 through 6 are the old mandatory ones from the bill. Number 7 is a new mandatory item, which was at one time one of the cafeteria pieces. And it has been put as a mandatory, and it says, federal state income tax returns in the name of the business are filed, or a business schedule C or farm schedule F is filed with the personal income tax filing each year. 8 then,
go ahead, Matt.
8 then becomes the cafeteria, and because we did take one out of the possible choices, the number was reduced from 4 to 3. The commercial advertising one has been changed to say commercial advertising. It did say trade journals, newspapers, other publications. There was some concern that it didn't specifically talk to the other media. So we just simply deleted in trade journals, newspapers. It says commercial advertising or business cards, as is customary in operating similar businesses, is purchased for the business or the individual or business entity of a trade association membership. That will take care of commercial advertising generally and take care of all the media. Then the on page 7, that was the area that had of the bill that had an information about the logging. Followers or buckers were not going to be subject to a sub F, which was part of the cafeteria. We just simply deleted that. They aren't subject to it in the amendments either. They have a choice just like everybody else of 3 of 5 of the cafeteria. And the last one that is not actually on the amendments is engrossed on the last page that you have of the amendments. It's there was some concern on the committee from other areas that person for this, this definition to include governmental agencies, and on line 11 there will be changed to be person includes partnership, joint ventures, association, corporations, governmental agencies, and sole proprietorships.
Where's that at again?
That's on page 7 of your amendments.
On page 7
you
of
have,
the bill?
You have it here, yeah. Page 7 of your bill.
Oh, okay, there it is. I'm sorry.
And there are a few changes on the other areas. It says furnishes on line on amendments, proposed amendments on line 15. The individual business entity providing labor services furnishes the tools. It used to say and equipment. It says tools or equipment necessary for performance of the contracted labor or services. And I want everybody to remember that the key words are for performance of the contracted labor services. So if somebody contracts, they come in and write a program, that's the contracted services, the personal services. That's what we're dealing with there.
That was what we tried to take care of. Of something that frankly hadn't even come up during the interim, these personal services contracts, and we hope that that clarifies that for those types.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dominey.
Also, it was my understanding in our discussion early on that where it says it provides tools and equipment, we, as I understood it, that did not mean they had to own the tools and equipment. If they could rent them, it just says that they're the ones that are responsible for getting the tools and equipment. That was my understanding early on. Is that correct?
It says providing labor services necessary. How you provide them is up to whatever contractual arrangement. Or
that's right. If you're leasing them, you are providing them.
Yeah. As long as you provide them. Somehow. Representative Durfler.
Does that mean all, you have to furnish all equipment?
In talking to the agencies about this, they're going to try and inject some reasonable, that was their term, reasonable test in this area. A question came up, for instance, on the dental hygienist, just to use an example, Representative Durfler, that maybe they don't provide the dental chair. It's hard to carry a dentist chair from place to place, but it's not to say that that person isn't providing their own hand tools for cleaning teeth and stuff. So the key here is that they're going to use a reasonable test, just as they currently do, but it's a good question for the record that we don't expect them to be unreasonable in applying this test. Rep. St. Johnson.
Can we have Larry Young come up here?
Sure. Mr. Young?
And, who else is from Lance?
Mr. Lent, I think, is here from employment.
Roger, you want to come up too?
It's a gentleman here from revenue.
Yeah, might as well.
Mr. Lent, you want to? How about the revenue department?
Here
they
are. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Rep. St. Mannix.
I was happy to hear some of the comments explaining some of the provisions, because we had a lot of testimony from people raising what I'll call horror stories about, on the original bill, where I think they misinterpreted the flexibility of the language, and where they raised a good point about the need for more flexibility. I think the amendments that were put together have incorporated that flexibility. The point about labor services, for instance, the key phrase there is for performance of the contracted labor services. You don't have to furnish all of the equipment and so forth. And a comment I wanted to make to add to that was in regard to the payment provision on lines 20 and 21 in the amendments. It was important to me that it talks about payment upon completion of the performance of specific portions of the project, because that gives you some flexibility. We want to make it clear that you're not dealing with wages for hourly employment. On the other hand, some people may be paid for professional service on an hourly basis. Lawyers, accountants, for instance, are paid that way. Other people may be paid on a daily rate for, say, the dental hygienist may be paid per patient, or they may be paid per day or per week. And this gives us some flexibility in being reasonable, but at the same time, the intention is not to allow someone to really be paying wages and call that a payment for specific portions of the project. Thank you.
appreciate that.
Representative Johnson, you had some questions?
Yes, the question that I'd like to ask of each of you, starting with Larry, is each of you, I understand, are involved in compliance, and so you must have heard every possible devious way to squeeze out from under the laws we've established. And over the last 10 years, we've tried to narrow that lid as much as possible. What is your assessment of this bill as it relates to that question I would ask, and that is, how many people are going to squeeze out from under this bill? Are we going to add to our problems? Is it worth the price or not? That's really what I want to get to. Are we going to add people who can escape from the requirement and become, in other words, they could become independent contractors more easily, or more readily, and maybe not be entitled to. I'd like to get your assessment in turn about where this is going.
Mr. Chairman, Larry Young, Workers' Compensation Division. Representative Johnson, I can't see it doing anything but tightening up and eliminating a lot of confusion as far as our investigators and the insurers' auditors as to who and who is not an independent contractor. And